You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This morning's topic is managing capital flows in the aftermath of the global crisis. There are apparently delays on some of the metro lines, so we may be getting two or three more people coming soon. But because some of our panelists have to leave fairly close to 10:30, we'll kick it off. Issue is, of course, that capital flows collapsed during the crisis are now beginning to come back, and there is a possibility, or at least there was, until the euro crisis reared its ugly head, there is a possibility that capital flows will surge again in a very big way, simply because of the very rapid growth in emerging markets, combined with the likelihood that policy interest rates in the industrial countries that determine essentially international interest rates will remain very low for an extended period. And so in that circumstance, the issue of how to manage a large amount of capital flow, although in some cases some countries will have the opposite problem, are again very topical. And to address the question, we have, it's customary to say that we have an outstanding panel, and so I try not to say it every time, but in this case, the three people to my right who I've known for a long time and are good friends are indeed, very few people know these issues better than Amar Bhattacharya, John Williamson, and Arturo Posenkansky. Amar is the director of the G24, which is a group of finance ministers of developing countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, a very influential group in the international financial institutions. He's also represents the group at the G20 meetings. And when we were colleagues at the World Bank, among the many things that Amar did was write a very comprehensive and a landmark report on capital flows to developing countries. John Williamson is, of course, known to you all. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute pretty much since its inception. He is, to him is attributed the infamous phrase, the Washington Consensus, something he has tried to live down ever since, without success. And he also spent some time at the World Bank, which is where we got to know each other when he was chief economist for the South Asia region. And Arturo Posenkansky spent 30 years on Wall Street. He's also trying to live that down. But actually, he's a very nice guy. And he worked essentially on emerging markets for a long time, and now he is visiting at the American University and helping enlighten a lot of the good policy discussion on the big issues here in Washington. So that's the introduction. You have a little bit more detail on them in the material that's been distributed to you. And we'll take them in that order. And I asked Amar to begin by giving us a little bit of a scene setting on capital flows before talking about some of the policy issues that are very, very close to his heart. Amar.
Thank you, Uri. It's a pleasure to be here and also a pleasure to share the podium with the people here, because I do know them and I agree that they are an outstanding panel. Uri asked me, and he did ask me, what, yesterday, Uri? No, day before yesterday, to do some stage setting. And I said to John Williamson, I said, I only do stage setting with pictures. So I'll put a few pictures up just to talk about capital flows, and then I'll come back to what I would call the story on responses, and I will distinguish between three types of responses, national responses, regional responses, and global responses. Now, I could do this in 3 hours. I'm going to do it in 10 minutes, so I will do it in a very telegraphic form. And then, you know, leave ample time for discussion. Okay, so the story on capital flows, actually there was a period in the 1990s in the, between the Mexican crisis and the Asian crisis when capital flows increased quite rapidly. But in this decade, as you can see, capital flows really began to increase very sharply after 2004. And they came... Really, there are some characteristics of these capital flows that are important to point out. One is that they were very much bank intermediated in the sense of origins of the capital flows and the intermediation domestically. And that's a very important aspect because it also there is an aspect associated with it, which is the credit channel and the domestic amplification. And as you can see, short-term debt, bank lending, bonds, three things that are very bank intermediated, dominated the increases. FDI was very big, but it was the more stable part, and I'll come to that in a second. So when you take out FDI out of the story, you can see how sharp the collapse of private capital flows was, as Uri pointed out, in the face of this crisis. And here is the regional story. And the regional story is very interesting because, as you can see, the boom was the biggest in the case of the yellow line, which is Eastern and Central Europe. But it's important to point out that there was an incipient boom really beginning in 2006, 2007 in pretty much every other developing region. This time, though, they were lucky. Before they could really have a big boom, the bust came. So it's an interesting part of the story of private capital flows in this crisis that Europe and Central, Eastern and Central Europe was where the big boom and the big bust took place, but there was actually, as I said, an incipient boom. Now, the other thing is that the recovery from this crisis has been faster in terms of access than any preceding recent financial crises. And you see that here in terms of the duration and the increases in the spreads on emerging market bonds. You can see that they increased. This is the spreads as of, actually, this last Friday, Uri, since. It has come down quite sharply. And, and as you can see this time round, it didn't remain that high for that long. Indeed, access to financial markets has really come back really big time, and it is in terms of loans, it's in terms of equities, and it's in terms of bonds. Moreover, this is not just an Asia story. Even in Europe, in parts of Europe where there's, you know, countries like Czech Republic, et cetera, where strength is good, access has been pretty, pretty fully restored. And indeed, we do not have very good numbers. I went through the WIO numbers this morning to see whether, you know, I could tease out more on what's happening. And there are not good short-term numbers in terms of capital inflows other than this, meaning what one would call volatile private capital flows. But when you look at pressures on the exchange rates, when you look at what's happening to reserves, you do find that there are surges in capital flows. Although in the last couple of weeks, with the uncertainties in Europe, everybody has been hit except for the U.S. Treasury bill. I just want to put this figure up, and I want to contrast private capital flows to something else that I will talk about, and that is official capital flows. And I'm not talking about grants and aid. I'm talking about lending by official institutions. And this story is really kind of dramatic. You saw this huge increase in private capital flows in the last decade, but if you look at official creditors, they were basically negative. Now, that has very important architectural implications, and I will come to that particularly when I will talk about the whimper of the package that was announced in the spring meetings for the World Bank. Okay, so these are the facts and figures. So in telegraphic form, let me go through some messages in terms of national responses, regional responses, global responses. National responses, the first thing you have to do is you have to continue, a message from that developing countries must take away is that you have to continue to work on the fundamentals. You know, the fiscal kind of vulnerabilities that have been exposed in this present crisis is not an issue as much for the developing world, but it cannot be taken for granted. I mean, I have pictures, I'm not putting them up here, but if you look, the debt to GDP ratios of the South continue to come down. Some people say that the effect of this crisis has been that growth went south and debt went north, you know. And in a sense, that's absolutely correct. I mean, the position of the developing world with regard to debt is pretty good, but it's not to be given. Second, financial systems. They have to continue to strengthen their financial systems. And indeed, when you look at capital adequacy in the developing world and emerging markets, it's much, much stronger than it is in the advanced countries. Third, they have to deepen their capital markets. They have to be able to have more flexible exchange rate policies, which means developing the monetary frameworks that allow for inflation targeting, more flexibility for more hedging. So there are lots of things that they have to do with respect to what I'd say continued work on the fundamentals. And the fact is that in the last 15 years, emerging markets and developing countries have done a lot, and that served them very well during this crisis. Second, they will continue to be buffeted, though, by private capital flows. In a recent seminar that Uri participated in, Olivier Blanchard said, well, you know, the composition of flows that we are seeing right now, the numbers that I put up, suggest that they are still pretty benign. You really don't have to worry about them. And let me disagree. And let me disagree on the following grounds. First, capital flows, like all financial flows, are pro-cyclical, but they are particularly pro-cyclical for developing countries. And in the following way. First, They are this problem of herding, of surges, all exacerbated by imperfect information and in the nature of the financial markets that originate the private capital flows. Second, what is apparently stable winds up being very unstable during bad times. So you have the problem of sudden stops and sharp reversals. And that creates problems, not in a temporary way, but in a very long-term way. Against that backdrop, what are the policies that developing countries need to have beyond the fundamentals? The first is they need to be able to manage private capital flows in the surges. And there the responses, first and foremost, are to ensure that you have addressed the prudential concerns. As I said, a lot of this lending is bank intermediated. And we found out in this crisis that home country regulation is just not good enough. Why? Because it really doesn't matter to the home country whether that marginal lending in that marginal country is good and bad. It does matter to the host country. So you have to worry about prudential regulations as the host country in terms of capital flows, given that so much of it is bank intermediated. Next, you need to worry about the macroeconomic aspects of it. Where appropriate, where there are not inflationary concerns, you might want to allow your interest to sterilize. If you cannot, you might want your interest rates to go up. On the other hand, you might want, where there is flexibility, you certainly want to allow some exchange rate flexibility. And by the way, in this crisis, we saw a lot of exchange rate flexibility on the part of emerging markets. We certainly want to explore the scope for fiscal tightening where that is appropriate. But in the end, you have to face the fact that in many situations, you know, these will not stem the tide, and you will need additional measures of the kind that Brazil announced and of the kind that some countries kept in place for long periods of time. The point I would make here is these responses are very state contingent. You can't say generally capital controls are the thing, or there is one type of capital controls. You know, it's an area which I believe requires a lot of nuancing, but it is part of an eclectic response. However, even if you deal with the capital flow surges, as I said, you will have outflows. And one of the things that we've learned is that we need to have contingency plans to be able to deal with sudden stops. These contingency plans, you know, for example, as we found out in Korea, must entail a plan on how do you deploy reserves. Are you going to use your reserves? Are you not going to use your reserves? What are you going to do in terms of contingent lines? What are you going to do in terms of the banking system, which becomes extremely exposed during a crisis? In the case of Brazil, for example, they use repos and swaps to provide support to the banking system with great, great effectiveness, because it's a very important part of maintaining the liquidity and the confidence in the banking system. So you need, as another pillar, a system which allows you to deal with this, with these sudden stops. So these are all what I would call the elements of a national system. In terms of regional responses, let me just highlight three points, again, telegraphically. The importance of regional surveillance. Second, the importance of regional financial arrangements of the kind that we have seen in East Asia. And third, the possibility of coordinated regional capital controls to avoid stigma effects. Okay. And I think they should all be on the table. With regard to global responses, we have had the most amount of focus. There has been a lot of emphasis on strengthening the capacity of the IMF in order to be able to respond to liquidity crisis. The resources were there before the European crisis. Possibly, you know, they will be enhanced through an additional quota increase, which is supposed to take place at the end of this year. We believe that that quota increase should at least be a doubling of quotas. But with that, I think the fund would probably have adequate resources, even if Europe requires additional resources. However, the IMF is not well equipped with the instruments to provide what I would call flexible, fast, speedy response to systemic crisis. They have put in place something called the flexible credit line. Some of you can have heard about it. I call it the Virgin Mary instrument. You have to be very pure to be eligible for it. And, you know, but we can build on it in terms of getting a better system from the fund. There's also a lot of discussion right now on improving the precautionary instruments that the fund has. All of this is in the right direction. However, the crisis has also pointed to the need for a better balance in the structure of financing. And let me explain what I mean by that. I showed you a graph which showed that official flows were basically insignificant in the face of large and volatile private capital flows. Now, the reality is that developing countries have large public goods needs, infrastructure, education, health. They also, increasingly, a lot of these public goods needs are very connected to global public goods, especially for climate change. And the orders of magnitude that we are talking about are not in the tens of billions, they're in the hundreds of billions of dollars. In the face of that, what's the arsenal that we have and how are we deploying it? The arsenal we have is the MDB system led by the World Bank. And so What did the World Bank agree on? The World Bank agreed on a selective capital increase of 25.8 billion, a general capital increase of 58.4 billion, so roughly about 86 billion. Sounds like a significant number. What does it mean? It means that after this crisis, the World Bank will be able to lend gross levels of about $15 billion a year. What that means is before the crisis, they were basically lending a little bit around zero. Now they will be able to lend at about $3 billion, which is zero. Okay? So in a sense, this great package that was announced is really a whimper. It's an insult, as I call it. And on top of the insult is now injury, meaning why? That the shareholders, the same shareholders that said we will not allow for a significant increase in capital, now want to raise loan charges on the borrowers in order to meet aid commitments that should be coming from their coffers. So I just wanted to end a little bit on a provocative note, but I do think that one of the fundamental messages here is not just to think about private capital, but what kind of a financing architecture makes sense. And that entails a better development financing architecture where the multilateral development banks would be playing a much, much bigger role in intermediating public goods, public finance for public goods, a much better liquidity response capacity embedded in the IMF under truly multilateral rules. But in order for that, the current set of shareholders have to set their vision and their sights much higher than it has been in the recent past. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I think you got a flavor there of the complexity of the issues and the need for pragmatic and as Amar said, state contingent approaches in this very complex setup. And let me take it on then to John.
Well, thank you very much. It's also a pleasure to be here and to share this platform with such distinguished company. When I received my instructions from UI yesterday afternoon, it was to talk about the ways in which one could react to a capital inflow. But let me say that in his concluding remarks, Emma ventured somewhat wider, and I think I want to stress that I agree with those remarks, and indeed I want to tell you of one thing that he told us before this meeting, which he didn't mention in his public remarks, which was that the developing countries had actually offered to subscribe to the World Bank and weren't allowed to by the developed countries. I think that's quite an interesting addendum to what he's said to you just now. But discussion that I wanted to concentrate on is essentially regarding the likelihood of capital inflows and how to deal with them. I think I agree that large private capital inflows are one of the important things which emerging markets have to be prepared for. And I think I would even extend it a little bit beyond the range of circumstances, the recovery of the sort which we thought a couple of months ago we were enjoying. If you look around the world today, there are several places that still look quite healthy, despite the somewhat dire circumstances. There's a flight for safety into US treasuries. We all know about that. German bonds are popular as well. And the third major element that's popular are emerging market bonds. You find very often, and I wouldn't be surprised if in this, maybe not this time, maybe next time, but very soon one is going to have the phenomenon of a flight to safety into emerging market bonds. And that is going to intensify the sort of problem that we are discussing at the present time. If they can make use of this capital in terms of increasing the amount of infrastructure provided or in terms of increasing the investment level in general, that's fine. But the point is that there's a demand side as well as a supply side. There's not only the need to the need which is increased by a capital inflow and a current account deficit, the supply of capital is increased. The demand for capital in general goes down because one, if one loses a competitive exchange rate, people don't want to invest. The danger is that one is going to see that sort of reaction in emerging markets and going to kill the goose which lays the golden egg. The popularity of emerging markets would on this reading be a very temporary thing. If they simply allow the capital inflow to push up the exchange rate, to increase the current account deficit, then they will undermine the basis on which the capital inflows are maybe this time, maybe in the future, taking place. So I think it is important to limit the capital inflow to what can be safely invested. I've placed this traditionally at something like 3% of GNP. That's the traditional figure. It's a rule of thumb. Nobody thinks that it's exactly right for every country and that no country can safely exceed 3%, that 4% is going to lead to disaster, even if it's temporary and whatnot. But one has to work on the basis of rules of thumb, and this seems to be what historical experience suggests is a pretty safe level. If one exceeds that level, then there is a danger of there being a debt crisis down the road. So the question becomes how to deal with excess capital inflow. Well, the first resort is always to intervene, and the question then arises, should one sterilize the inflow? And with some countries that can be done without an excessive cost. If one has a repressed internal financial system, then it is possible to intervene and sterilize on a very large scale. China has shown that very well. There is, in fact, a very low interest rate paid, so that not counting the potential depreciation of the dollar against the renminbi at some stage, they are actually making a profit on their intervention at the present time. The interest rate which they receive on U.S. Treasury bills exceeds the interest rate which they pay in sterilizing the capital inflow. But that's pretty unusual. I think Chile was spending about 1% of GNP on sterilizing its inflow in the mid-1990s, and that's a significant amount of money. And that's much more typical of what is involved. If you knew that the exact length of time that this capital inflow is going to continue, then it would be simple. You'd simply buy it and add it to reserves at a level which would enable you to make a profit when you sold it again. And so the authorities would make a profit on the deal, and they'd stabilize the exchange rate in the process. But of course, you don't have that sort of foreknowledge. And so it's risky intervening, building up reserves, which become expensive to sterilize, and you don't know when you or if you're going to be able to sell this money again and sell it at a profit. So usually countries want to... They get uneasy when there is a very large intervention and sterilization. They can, instead of sterilizing, they can vary the reserve requirements. They can prevent monetary expansion on the basis of a given capital inflow by raising the reserve requirements. Well, that again is a policy which may make sense in the in a small measure, but becomes expensive if it's pushed to excess, because one in that way one limits the monetary expansion, one increases the interest differential between domestic and foreign borrowing, and that's what one is wanting to do, but it becomes expensive if pushed to extreme, because it involves the banks taking a hit, and eventually this becomes unattractive. An alternative, which may be available in some countries, is to have government-controlled financial institutions switch their deposits from the commercial banks to the central bank. That's, again, something which was done in parts of East Asia with the government-controlled postal savings banks, and they switched their deposits from the commercial banks to the central bank. That, again, is a sensible reaction in the small, but it raises the cost of intermediation, and it becomes unattractive if it's pushed too far. There's the possibility of reacting as Europe did in the 1950s by liberalizing imports. Well, if you have imports controlled to begin with at an undesirably high level, that's a reaction which makes sense. But suppose that you've already negotiated import liberalization, as most countries have now, then this really isn't an option. another possibility may be to liberalize capital outflows. If you simply liberalize capital outflows, then there's a danger of, in fact, provoking the inflow. This has been established empirically in a number of papers. Because inflows are determined essentially by confidence that you can get the money out again if the need arises. So you may, in fact, encourage a net inflow if you liberalize outflows. If you liberalize just part of the outflows, I think the chances are better. If you liberalize FDI, then there's not a big chance that people are going to increase their investments in the country, because FDI is liberalized, FDI outflows are liberalized. And the same thing if you can allow pension funds to invest. But again, the Chilean experience is quite telling. In the mid-1990s, the Chileans liberalized capital outflows by pension funds. They allowed the pension funds to invest more, and they didn't. They simply sat. They were making very nice returns in Chile, and they didn't, in fact, put the money outside the country until there was a weakening of the peso. And then they saw the returns on holding dollars skyrocket compared to the peso returns. So, of course, it was at that stage, just when you didn't want a capital outflow, that the pension funds added to the capital outflow. So one has to be a little bit careful as to how this is done. there's a policy which is very popular with economists, was mentioned by Emma, which is to tighten fiscal policy. And I assure you, I say this every time. This should be, if you read an IMF recent IMF report, it was full of how you responded to capital inflows by tightening fiscal policy. Sure, I can just imagine the central banker going to the president and saying, the finance minister going to the president and saying, we have to raise taxes and cut expenditures. And he says, why? And he says, the foreigners want to lend us so much money. Doesn't add up politically. It's a difficult sell. I mean, it's right, but it's not the sort of thing where one can rely on having an enthusiastic reception and a large-scale acceptance of the message. So fiscal policy should be tightened, sure. There's the possibility of raising private savings as an alternative to tightening fiscal policy. Well, as an abstract objective, that's fine, but I want to know the instruments which one would suggest using, and they're not evident. There may be some artificial encouragements to capital inflows, for example, insurance of bank deposits or grants to FDI investors. And such artificial stimulants should be withdrawn. That's fine. One may have limited flexibility of exchange rates. The idea there would be that hopefully investment is going to be determined by the center of the band, while it would be capital flows would be more influenced by the market exchange rate, where the market exchange rate lies within the band. And maybe so one allows a strengthening of the exchange rate within the band, and the idea is that then this could discourage the capital inflow. Well, I have tended to abandon the schemes for limited flexibility of exchange rates, mainly because governments have been so wanton in defending indefensible exchange rates that all credibility has been lost at this stage. There are very few governments which, in fact, have not said they'll stick by a parity, even when the parity was absurdly overvalued or undervalued, and thereby the market has learnt to disregard these pronouncements. And one may also limit the ability of private banks to make foreign exchange loans, and in that way try to discourage capital inflows through the banking system. One may, for example, insist that if you make a foreign exchange loan, then that has to be provided against more, there has to be a bigger reserve against such a loan. And in that way, one would discourage them and hopefully discourage the capital inflow. So there are a series of measures that can be taken. It's not true that if one has an exchange rate objective, that there are no policy levers that can be pulled, but they don't amount to, they don't add up to giving one certainty that one can forestall a large inflow unless you're going to sterilize on an indefinitely large scale, as the Chinese appear to be prepared to do. And as I say, the circumstances in which allow the Chinese to do that are pretty unusual. One is then thrown back on the possibility of employing capital controls. We don't have an enormous understanding. I think in the first place, one knows that they work. They work imperfectly, we know that. There are always leakages, but one can still hope to achieve something through capital controls. There have been lots of examples of cases in which where capital controls have been imposed, they in fact have led to large, it's proved costly to overcome them. Price measures are preferable because otherwise one has the danger of imposing an absolute prohibition on certain outflows and not on others, and or certain inflows and not on others. And these will be don't reflect the importance to the individual of making that particular transfer, so they can. Price measures really avoid that. They leave the ultimate decision up to the individual while they get the collective decision. They provide scope for influencing the decisions collectively. but I think in general the private sector will discover ways of arbitraging ground controls. That, again, seems to be a fairly general rule. And the answer to that is to limit their duration wherever possible, to not have controls a permanent feature of the situation, but to have them for limited periods. I don't think there's any longer a doctrinal objection to capital controls per se, and therefore we can hope that the IMF in future might advise countries on when they need capital controls, not simply recognizing them ex post, but might provide countries with advice on how to impose controls, how and when to impose controls, and I think that would be a great advance, and that is something which we can indeed hope for in the future. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. So, thank you, John. So, just to summarize quickly, John's position is that you don't want current account deficits, big capital inflows, much larger than 3% of GDP. Therefore, it's very important to avoid real exchange rate appreciation. Do a whole list of possible reactions to avoid real exchange rate appreciation due to large capital inflows. Most of them having to do with broader policy measures, concluded that there'll be instances where you can only get so far by using those instruments, and then argued in favor of capital controls in those situations where the other instruments are not working. That's what I understood. And now we turn to Arturo with his long experience in Wall Street, and we ask him what he thinks of the idea that capital control should be constrained to 3% of GDP, and if that those kinds of limits are breached, that all sorts of policy arsenal measures should be brought to bear to reduce them.
Thank you, Uri, for the invitation, and thank you for my fellow panelists for a very interesting morning. So I would like to start by saying that I find the title of the presentation today, or the discussion, Managing Capital Controls, as an oxymoron. I mean, it's like, you know, preventing financial bubbles or smoothing the housing market cycle or softening the boom-bust of commodity prices, or, you know, managing traffic around the Washington, D.C. area, or winning the war on drugs, or, you know, you name it. I mean, I find we're making a mistake by not admitting how hard it is to manage most things. And if nothing else, look at Europe, right? It's an object lesson in the past several months of how difficult, if not impossible, it is to manage expectations, to manage financial flows, to manage even fiscal policy. I mean, and need we go back to 2008 or 2007 and recognize there how difficult it was to manage behavior in the financial markets or even in the financial industry, and the role of governments in what happened and the failure of regulation and whatever. So I think a conversation about a topic like this, when money is so much easier to move from one country to the other than ever before, and it's so much easier to move, of course, than goods, or including narcotics and so on, we should start with a dosage of humility and to say that you know, intellectually, it's a very interesting topic, but in practical terms, anybody who has managed money, who has been close to it, knows that, well, it's very difficult to manage money, especially where it goes, or what happens to it once you invest it or you spend it. So I would like to first make that point. I think that we're fooling ourselves if we think that, that we can manage money, and we've had an object lesson of this in the past 3 years, and certainly in the last month, because if you look at all the April projections made by the IMF and the IIF and various other bodies that make projections of capital flows, hello, here we are in May, and the world is looking very different. All the measures of risk aversion have turned completely around, 180 degrees, whether you look at Fed funds future, which used to predict that the Federal Reserve would be raising rates by year end, and now it doesn't, or the boom in the junk bond market, which basically used to predict that below investment grade corporations would do very well and pay all their obligations and so on, and you know, spreads in that market have widened considerably. And of course, the flight to quality in treasuries, treasury yield for 10-year treasuries was closer to 4%, and now it's closer to 3%. No matter which measure you look at, things have turned around 180 degrees in terms of sentiment and where the capital is going from a month ago. Imagine anybody, you know, even pretending to be able to have done anything about it in April, or to do anything about it in May, or to do something about it in June. So I think we have to be very humble. There are certain things we can do, of course, if we try to at least not add to the problem. That maybe we can do, not add to the problem. So how do you not add to the problem if you believe that capital flows could be a problem? As was mentioned here, the first thing you want to do is to have as flexible an exchange rate regime as possible, not only because flexible exchange rate regimes have been shown to discourage currency mismatches and maturity mismatches, which is what leads a lot of banks, corporations, and governments, and even individuals to get themselves into trouble sooner or later, but also by employing the price signaling mechanism. You know, if you let the exchange rate appreciate when there's too much capital coming in, what you're doing is you're making it expensive for foreigners or locals who are bringing back their money. You're making it expensive for them to buy assets denominated in your currency, and you're making it cheaper for foreigners or locals to invest abroad, because it's cheaper to buy dollars, euros, or yen, or whatever. So at least, you know, if you don't want to add to the problem, then have as flexible an exchange rate regime as politically possible. The other element, you've heard it here, there's things that you hope you can achieve through prudential regulation of banks in particular. I say hope to achieve because, of course, everything that we had hoped to achieve, when you think of all the time and effort that went into devising and implementing the Basel rules and umpteen other things that were cooked up by the regulatory industry here and around the world, how it utterly failed. To prevent what happened, utterly failed to prevent. Because until they shut their doors, the likes of Northern Rock or Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers were absolutely in compliance with, you know, Basel and all the other regulations. Nobody has accused them of having flouted regulations, so imagine. So we can hope maybe, you know, through prudential measures, to ride this wild horse a little bit better. You can try, since you have supervisory or other responsibilities, to have the banking system at least, which you know is gonna come knocking at your door at the first sign of trouble, so, because there is no such thing as too big to fail. There is no such thing as too small maybe to fail. You know, you can impose some prudential guidelines on financial intermediaries and hope that they will obey them in the law and in the spirit. But as I say, you know, even that is a thing. The other thing that was not mentioned maybe is you can make the risks and not just the opportunities of investing in emerging markets more transparent. Thank you, President Chavez and others, for reminding us that, you know, foreign companies can be nationalized, property rights can be trampled upon, exchange rates can be mismanaged, et cetera. You know, fiscal policy can go in the pro-cyclical instead of the anti-cyclical direction. Without the likes of Venezuela and Argentina, you know, we wouldn't know what not to do. Yes, you know, I think that on the transparency side, that wasn't mentioned. I think that it's maybe, as I say, by requiring that corporations, financial intermediaries, and governments themselves highlight the risks of investments that insurance companies, pension funds, hedge funds, whatnot, are undertaking, maybe you can get them to count to 10 before they plunk down the next billion, so on. And the rest was mentioned, fiscal policy. You can try to have some anti-cyclical type of fiscal policy. It's hard. I won't even go into discussion of the capital controls. You had here a session on capital controls about the controversial paper that was issued by the research department. I call it the exception that proves the rule, because the IMF research department puts out such good things, but then these policy notes that they've been putting out as of lately, they make me shake my head. But fortunately, I hope they will remain the exceptions to their rule. In sum, I think that you know, managing capital flows is a very debatable issue, not just ideologically speaking, but in practice. We should be very humble when approaching this topic, very tentative in our conclusions, very hesitant in any policy recommendations. But at least we know what to avoid. We want to avoid rigid exchange regimes. We want to avoid lack of transparency. We want to avoid currency and maturity mismatches. We want to avoid fiscal policies that are pro-cyclical and things like that, to at least not make inflows and outflows of capital more volatile and more dangerous, potentially dangerous, than they already are. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arturo. I'm not going to summarize what Arturo said because he's just summarized it. So no reflection. I thought they were terrific comments. And a very strong counterpoint to the position taken by Amar and John. Before opening it up, I'm going to ask a question of the panel, which is of a very topical nature. The question is like this. The euro crisis is, in the light of many observers, in the view of many observers, not so much a fiscal crisis, but a competitiveness crisis in the most vulnerable countries. Hugely appreciated real exchange rates, if you compare unit labor costs in Germany and Greece, or Germany and Italy, or Germany and Spain, for example. In that light, what can the euro crisis teach us about managing capital flows to developing countries, if anything? The other way, what can the big and literature on managing capital flows, which we heard exposed today, discussed extremely well, I thought, today, what does that literature tell us about the euro crisis and how to avoid it? So I'd like to ask them if they have any comments in that direction. And I didn't warn them I was going to ask the question. I know it's not an easy question. And then we'll turn it, and then I'll turn to the audience for questions and comments. And if you don't mind, we'll just follow the order, Amar.
Well, I think it's, to start with, Uri, it's useful to distinguish between two different euro crises, the crises of Eastern and Central Europe, which one forgets is also a European crisis, and the crisis of Southern Europe, which is a European crisis. Now, in both cases, you really had excessive private sector borrowing and lending, and you had fiscal policy being pro-cyclical. Okay? So, I mean, that's in a nutshell, that's the way I would see it. However, Eastern Europe seems to be coming out of it, despite the pain, much better than the prospects for Southern Europe, in part because, in my view, for two things. One is their fiscal situation was, the stock positions were not as bad. And second, the populations in Eastern Europe are more used to tough adjustment. So I think that's why, you know, Latvia, for all its, you know, difficulties, is coming out better. In the case of Southern Europe, I agree that, you know, there is a competitiveness problem, but there was also an excessive private sector lending boom in all these countries. I mean, everybody talks about the adjustment in Greece, but if you look at per capita income of Greece, it doubled in a decade. You know, there was a huge boom preceding this crisis. So, you know, in a sense, therefore, adjustment is actually partly a reaction to something that was ephemeral, in my view. Okay. So, but in part of the problem is that, you know, because of the demographics and everything else, the fiscal adjustment comes at a time which is very difficult, and one doesn't easily see a kind of a competitive private sector in the kind that Germany has in Southern Europe. So I actually am quite worried about it. And as you know better than I do, the fiscal situations in Greece, you know, Spain and Portugal are very different, Italy. So, you know, the solutions, again, in my view, have to be really tailored very much to the specific circumstances.
Well, I agree with Amar's distinction between Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. I think it's a lot of us were surprised at how Eastern Europe did adjust to the situation and appeared to be coming out of it okay. You know, there were some quite serious sacrifices made. There were was it Latvia or was it Estonia where they had the fall of GDP by something close to 30%? Well, way over 20%. It was so that they paid a high price for it, but they had made the adjustment. Many of us hadn't taken on board was just how vulnerable Southern Europe was. It was part of the euro area, and therefore we thought of it as all encompassed with the euro and wouldn't involve the outside world, wouldn't involve the IMF, and we were wrong. Quite clearly we were wrong. I think nowadays I worry a lot more about those high debt-to-GDP levels which we see in Greece than I did before. I mean, admittedly these are external debt-to-GDP figures, but for Australia and New Zealand, they're also very high. And they're going on increasing indebtedness merrily and saying, oh, we're different. You know, no crisis, no danger of crisis here. Never is a danger of a crisis until it happens. And they look to me to be making themselves very vulnerable at the present time. So I think we need to learn that there are some countries that build up these big debts. Now, admittedly, it's a big distinction in Europe that they had gone to a single currency and therefore they didn't have the possibility of Greece devaluing vis-a-vis the other European countries, which is an important channel of escape. And it's clear that it was a mistake for countries that had not securely achieved the same level of inflation as Germany to tie themselves into a currency union with Germany and the other countries of the North, which had achieved that very low level of inflation and therefore which don't have and won't have in the future similar problems of competitiveness arising. So that I think is a serious difference. Therefore, I think that in the case of Greece, one does have to worry as to whether it's going to succeed in coming out of its situation without a measure of debt forgiveness. I don't think that involves withdrawing from the euro, which in fact would probably at this stage make things even worse. But I can't see it getting into a... I think it's very difficult to see it emerging clearly from the crisis program that has been announced.
Thank you, John.
Yeah. Uri, I would answer it as follows, that supply side or structural factors, be they demographic or competitiveness issues or, you know, savings deficits or surpluses or things like that, they, in my experience, they have very little to do with financial cycles. I think the financial cycles have more to do with short-term and, well, more financial issues of debt issuance and exchange rate risk and monetary policy and the cost of speculation and margin rules and all kinds of things like that. And again, let's just look at what happened, right? How many people predicted that we would have a crisis, Nouriel Roubini among them, not because of something that was gonna happen the way it happened, or is happening now the way it's happening now, but you know, because the Chinese would get tired of buying US treasuries and stuff like that. I mean, poppycock. The fact is that, yes, we had some crises, but for very different reasons and in very different ways. And we may have a savings deficit, but when people are scared, they still buy dollar against as well as gold and oil. So they run to the dollar, not away from the dollar when things start to shake. And it's an example. Yes, you know, when we emerge of all this, we'll still come out with a savings problem. We save too little. No wonder we have such big current account deficits. Even during a recession, we have a big current account deficit. So it just went down from 6% to 3%. But, you know, it's not zero or positive three. So we definitely have an issue. And these many of these countries at the periphery do have a competitiveness problem. But I would say it was mostly the fiscal mismanagement. If you're looking at the trigger for all this, was the day that Greece announced that its budget deficit was not 3% plus of GDP, but 13 plus of GDP. That's when confidence was completely lost. Because, as I was saying before, that's why the transparency issue is so important. Because if you surprise the market, it will react to good news and to bad news. So the best thing is not to deliver news, but to be transparent all the time so that they get a chance to absorb it. And the other things that, so I would say the importance of financial variables, including fiscal variables, is very important. I joke that the IMF, which always used to stand for it's mostly fiscal, or it's mostly fiscal stupid, then went to mean it's mostly financial. And thank goodness they've realized that, where their comparative advantages, and they've gotten back to being, it's mostly fiscal. I think we'd be better off if they hadn't had a detour. But anyway, what else have we learned from Europe? Well, first of all, that confidence, or the lack thereof, cannot be taken for granted. It's like at the individual level, right? Maybe we can get away with some peccadilloes here and there, you know, as long as nobody's watching. But one day the light switch will go on, and we'll be caught in the act. And so confidence is very fickle, or the lack of confidence can be very fickle too. And so I think that some of these governments, they thought they were having a free ride, and I would say they were having more than a free ride. Either some of the original members, like the ones around the periphery on the west, or some of the new and wannabe members on the periphery of the east. I think they had a halo effect from the whole EU membership and eventual euro adoption thing, and that led them to become overconfident. And so they made some of the mistakes that in Latin America and Asia we've learned not to make. We've learned the hard way from the 90s and 80s not to make. And the other thing we knew before, and that is that if you don't have the exchange rate instrument to signal the right things, namely you have no currency or you have a fixed exchange rate, then you better have other policy instruments that signal to the markets what to do or what not to do. Maybe they won't be paying attention, but at least you will have done your job signaling. So, of course, if you don't have the ability to devalue, as a number of these countries used to rely on, remember the ERM crisis 20 years ago and so on, then you better be very competitive. You better keep your fiscal house in order. You better keep your banks well supervised and so on. Otherwise, when you know the confidence and the good times or the music stops, you're going to find yourself, you know, with the lights shining hard on you, and then, you know, all your wrinkles show.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Well, we have time for a few questions. Yes, the lady at the back.
Hi, I'm Krista Tuomi from American University. I thank you very much. This has all been fascinating. I just want to take issue or say that I'm a little nervous about the comments about capital controls. I think perhaps the studies and the focus have been too focused on those large, relatively successful developing countries which can afford to perhaps make a few mistakes, policy mistakes, that is. They're still desirable. I've done, you know, working a lot in Africa and looking at the interactions between different types of capital and FDI and the micro effects of capital controls. I'm just a bit worried that if the IMF, as you mentioned, puts out some policy guidelines on when, gives the green light per se in any formal manner, you will have a whole bunch of very small, uncompetitive countries feeling like this is the go-ahead, when they can ill afford to implement these type of policies, in the sense that, as you've mentioned, circumstances change rapidly, and you can go from being the darling of the week and having a policy that, you know, encourages or discourages inflows to suddenly desperately needing those. And policy does not change as quick as circumstances do, especially in small countries. Are you not a bit nervous, as you mentioned, those wanton countries with regards to exchange rates, that there won't be a lot of wanton countries having the same effect with regards to capital controls?
Who would like to pick that up? John and perhaps Hama too?
Yes.
I think that the big danger of capital controls is that they lead the authorities to overestimate how effective they're going to be, and thereby to think that they can ignore the fundamentals. And in fact, they're complement to the fundamentals. So you have to get the fundamentals right anyway. The capital controls are an additional tool which, in my view, a country which is capable of employing them effectively, that does include Chile, but it doesn't include all the African countries, and maybe the ones you're thinking of, I don't know, but certainly there are a number of sub-Saharan African countries where they don't care of imposing capital controls effectively. They could tempt the policymakers into thinking they have far more control than in fact they have. So I think that's a genuine worry, and that's a factor that does need to be worked into the situation when one decides on one's policy.
Aman?
I could trace a little bit of South Africa in your accent. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, right. Let me just say that South Africa, as a country, has one of the most sophisticated system of capital controls in place, has had it for a long time, continues to practice it with great finesse. Okay. However, South Africa's problems are extremely different from that of the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. So I would say can capital controls be distortionary? And the answer is absolutely yes. And there is no basis, in my view, to have capital controls against foreign direct investment. I mean, so I was really distinguishing very much between equity flows and debt flows. And even on debt flows, it's very state contingent. It depends on the nature of your domestic, you know, where you are. And as I said, you continue to work on your fundamentals, but you can use capital controls. Arturo mentioned, you know, Venezuela. And yeah, Venezuela is one of the worst cases of capital controls. But the country I come from, India, uses capital controls in a fairly sophisticated way, recognizing the vulnerabilities in its own system. And it manages to generate very high rates of growth and, you know, manages to avoid crises. So I don't think that, you know, the answer is one size fits all. And, you know, yes, in Africa, I think, you know, the problem is as much capital outflight, not because of capital, you know, of excess of capital, but because of other reasons. So I think the message that John at least gave, and I have learned a lot from him over the years, is a rather eclectic message. It's not saying that, you know, start with capital controls, you know, but you have to look at, capital flows creating a problem for you? And the answer is, if you looked at Southern Europe, and with the benefit of hindsight, there was huge excess financial flows into Southern Europe. Did governments amplify it? Yes. But even beyond that, there was a big case for having had some kind of both prudential as well as macroeconomic responses. So I think that, you know, even in more sophisticated countries, you need to now rethink whether a complete laissez-faire approach is necessarily good. And in that sense, I do sort of disagree with Arturo. I actually think the fund's report is on the mark. And, you know, in most kind of official circles, we think it's actually the right way for the fund to go. So, that's a good issue of debate. So I think, you know, this issue of, you know, we'll continue to have religious divides on both sides.
Very good. There is, of course, the moral hazard argument against capital controls, that, you know, by having capital controls, maybe you don't do as much as Arturo would like on transparency and fiscal probity and having an appropriate exchange rate system. And we have here Alejandro Foxy, who's with Carnegie and former finance minister of Chile. So he, I'm sure, has something to say.
Well, this has been, I think, a very, very interesting session. Let me just put a slightly different perspective to analyze the capital controls issue, and that is a development perspective. You have developing countries that are trying to move up in the value chain in production and in exports. You have some big players there, big companies, multinationals, and so on. But what you really want is that a lot of medium-sized, small companies go competitive and are able to export and hopefully diversify the export basket. So if that is really a priority, then what happens with the exchange rate is something which is very critical. If the rest of the world is, quote unquote, relatively well managed, financially speaking, then flexible exchange rates without any constraints are perfect. But when you have this extreme volatility in capital flows, and you say basically you know, free exchange rates are, free floating exchange rate are okay. Well, it might happen, as it has happened in many places. The cost of that is that you destroy a lot of not yet consolidated exporters, and medium-sized and small-sized companies. That has a tremendous impact on employment, but in terms of the confidence of the entrepreneurs at home, you know, it's devastating. So that's an argument from a different point of view. Now, in our own experience, have capital controls worked or not? They have. I was in government when we did that in the early 90s. I was Minister of Finance. Of course, capital controls is just one instrument among many. And you never, when you're a policymaker, you never fix your attention in just one instrument, because no single instrument will solve the problem. What we did at the time was exchange rate was appreciating very fast. We did several things simultaneously. We reduced external tariffs, 5 points, across the board. We incentivated Chilean companies, including pension funds, to invest abroad, and we put some kind of capital controls. The results were, I think, rather positive in terms of what happened with exports, what happened with GDP, and so on. The growth rate of the Chilean economy under that kind of package was almost 8% a year, and the increase in exports was above 10% a year with, you know, this kind of intervention. So I don't think we have to be so orthodox. And on the other hand, we have to really take into account the devastating political impact and impact in terms of social cohesion of this extreme volatility in the financial markets in the world. And when you say, you know, as Arturo suggested, we cannot really do very much about it because these people are so clever and they work so fast that nobody can follow them and they will always surprise us, then, you know, I think what we have then in the future is very unstable economies and politics. I mean, we'll see what happens with the Greece government. You know, several governments already fell in Eastern Europe at the first phase of the shock, and I don't want to imagine what that would mean in terms of Latin America. There will be many Chavez around if this thing is not dealt with adequately.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. Any reactions to that?
I totally agree.
He totally agrees? You agree?
I agree, yeah. I think that was...
Yeah, Arturo.
I think it was aimed at me.
Arturo.
I mean, I think that... Anyway, the Chilean experience has been studied a lot, as you know. There are a lot of studies, and there are, again, I would caution a humble approach on the part of those who read the numbers one way or read the numbers in another way, because we can't do scientific experiments. You know, we can't run the 90s in Chile over again when they had this signals coming from the government without them, and see what happened. My bet was that the economy would have grown just as well, but how could I be proven right or wrong? We don't know. So we have to be very humble, even examining the historical record, and so we join, I think, the historians in reinterpreting history all the time, because it's a social science and emphasis on social. The other thing is, I think there's a bit of a bit of an inconsistent approach, wanting modernity and open markets and all the good things that you can get for cheap, including, in this case, money, and then complaining about it and being volatile. I mean, I think, you know, if you want to just rely on your own savings, and your own investment and things like that, as China and India did for a long time and so on. Well, good luck to you. You don't have to import if you don't want to. You don't have to export if you don't want to. Fine, you know. But I think, again, there's quite a bit of evidence that, especially if you don't lack the if you don't have the savings, to have a model of growth based on your own capital rather than somebody else's capital, all else being equal, is going to be much more difficult, much more painful, and much slower and much less efficient. So it's the same thing with trade. You know, you want to buy things for cheap from China, then don't complain that they have a trade surplus. You know, you're buying it. Okay, you don't want to buy that stuff anymore. You want to pay expensive for things? Well, then fine, then go ahead and you know, break the dependence on Chinese exports. So I think that we have to be consistent here. And there are still a lot of people who feel that they can cherry pick. You know, I like this about globalization, but not that. And I like this about financial markets, but not that, and so on. And I think it's just unrealistic, because the interconnections are such that, unfortunately, you get the whole package or you don't. And there's very little that you can do around the edges to smooth that animal.
And Arturo, presumably two of the three prescriptions that Alejandro mentioned, which are the reduction of external tariffs and allowing pension funds to invest abroad, you would not object to?
No, because I think I think people should be free to buy what they want and to invest where they want.
Can I just say that I think the point about Alejandro's intervention that was missed by Arturo was the point about the virtues of keeping the exchange rate competitive. And I think that was the big mistake in Arturo's presentation, that he presented exchange rate flexibility as though it was the answer to everything. In fact, exchange rate flexibility involves the exchange rate going up. When it goes up, things don't work out in the sort of implicit economic model that Arturo had in mind. It's not true that every investor has rational expectations. A lot of investors think extrapolatively. If they see something going up, they assume it's good to get into it. So the exchange rate goes up and goes up far too far, and it becomes then the small producers become uncompetitive. And that is why we want to keep it down, and we think that it may, under some circumstances, be necessary to have capital controls.
One of the beauties of the debate on capital controls is it's a little microcosm of the bigger debate about whether markets should be free or fettered. But it comes together in a very, very telling context. I'm going to ask one more question, brief question from one more, because our panelists actually have to leave. So a quick question, one more question, and then we'll turn to the panel very quickly for concluding comments. Two more quick questions. Gianni and the lady there on the left. I hate to leave a lady out. Go on.
Okay. I have a double questions, but brief. One would be about the U.S. deficit and whether the current account deficit of the U.S. Ought to be, in John's view, also subject to his rule of 3%. And you know, if we are going to face trouble looking ahead. And the other one is that one big mechanism for assessing also the riskiness of various investments, debt investments, is these rating agencies. And they've failed before. They've failed now in the case of Greece and Portugal and Spain in warning and in foreseeing the crisis. And, how do you see the role of these agencies and this huge, important role that, in fact, the SEC gave these agencies rating investment-grade companies?
And the lady? Please introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you. I'm Jo Marie Griesgraber. I head up a group called New Rules for Global Finance, and I'm one of those social scientists, but I suggest that economics is no science, as we've seen of late. And I'd love to throw just a few, sorry, I came in late, hand grenades, short. I would suggest that there's a difference between investment and gambling, and countries should be open to investment but not gambling. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. I'm sorry to be impolite, to make it short. Okay, we go back to the panel in inverse order. Arturo, quickly, some quick concluding comments, answers.
Well, I won't comment on the U.S. deficit question. About the rating agencies, I mean, in my view, the rating agencies provide a huge service that people are willing to pay for. So they'll be around as long as they're perceived to provide such a service. And yes, they get things wrong, but as long as they get things wrong, you know, less often than without them, people will still listen to what they have to say, and they will gladly pay for their service. And just to clarify, the SEC never gave the agencies, I mean, the agencies exist from before the SEC. Why? Because private investors wanted to have an outside opinion on the railroad and other bonds that they were buying at the turn of the previous century. And I think that the rating agencies will be here long after the SEC is gone. And with regard to investing versus gambling, yeah, I'm sorry you missed some of the grenades that I lobbed myself. But I would say you fall, I gather, in that category that I was talking about people who want, you know, this aspect of the enchilada but not the whole enchilada. And good luck to you. Well, good luck to you.
Go on, John.
Certainly, I think that the United States should take account of the 3% limit, and that's a good limit for the United States as for other countries, and it should therefore make a national objective of reducing its current account deficit to a maximum of 3% of GNP. That's written into the type of exercise that we do, trying to figure out what is the fundamental exchange rate of the dollar. And I think that sort of exercise makes good sense. I don't think that one should thereupon subject everything to this objective, but it should be an objective, and it should be a serious contributor to the debate. On the credit rating agencies, the Arturo said that they'd been around as long as they would be around as long as people were willing to pay for them. Look, people are forced to pay in order to get a rating, but they go shopping. They find the who'll give them the highest rating, and then they pay them the money. And of course, if you have that sort of incentive system, then you get Greece rated very highly until it faces a crisis, and then all of a sudden, the rating agencies amplify the crisis by downgrading Greece, just at the time when they should be upgrading Greece, or at least they should be encouraging people to go into Greece if they were engaged in a socially constructive endeavor. Of course, there should be... there need to be incentives so that Greece, but once Greece has agreed that it will take measures which are believed to be sufficient to achieve the objectives, then it becomes a serious risk again. As I indicated previously, I'm not sure that Greece, in fact, has yet committed to sufficient, but... that's not primarily Greece's fault. I don't think it's been as sufficient. But the point is that government, I mean, it's written into law that you, if you're a pension fund, you cannot hold anything other which is not investment grade, according to the credit rating agencies. Now, that then obliged pension funds to sell their Korean assets when Korea got downgraded in the fall of 1997, late 1997, early 98. And that was a big destabilizing element in the Korean situation. So it's not that people are completely, that they're anxious to have these credit rating agencies, that they're a big constructive effort. Government forces credit rating agencies on the country, and I think that there's exactly what reforms they should be, I'm not at present clear, but that the system needs reform urgently, I'm not in doubt.
Thank you, John. Aman?
Sorry. I was just going to say to Jo Marie that I don't think you can pick and choose between the investments and the gambling. I would love to, but I don't think one
sounds
can.
Sounds like we agree on something.
Apologies, John. Aman, please.
I'm also, I mean, much as I think you need to worry about, capital flows, I think it's very difficult to actually distinguish, this has been my perennial debate, for example, with Stephanie Griffith-Jones. I mean, I just don't think investors invest and they can look for short-term returns or long returns, but it's very difficult ex ante to say what's gambling or not gambling. But the spirit I fully subscribe to. Now, on credit rating agencies, they're clearly pro-cyclical. The question is it because of natural myopia of this normal cycles, or is it because there are some incentive properties associated with credit rating agencies? The G20 has been considering this. Actually, I participated in some of the discussions. And, there's a recognition that you have to address some of the incentive properties. And the latest financial regulation package moves in that direction. But the U.S. has been in the international discussions the biggest defender of credit rating agencies, for the obvious fact that most of them are, of course, U.S.-based. But this is something very much on the agenda. Let me also say that the rating agencies are only part of the puzzle. The other missing elements are, countercyclical capital requirements, on which there's a lot of debate right now, and the other is what to do about macroprudential regulations. There's no real agreement on these aspects as yet, but they are on the table, and there's, again, a lot of debate and discussion on them. On the 3% of the U.S. Current account deficit, my answer is absolutely yes, because there is an exorbitant privilege that the U.S. enjoys with the kind of deficit because it is the reserve currency. And that issue has brought to the fore the whole debate about the international reserve system right now and, whether you want a kind of this exorbitant privilege or not. So if the U.S., the short-run fact is that the U.S. has exorbitant privilege because it is a safe haven, but as John suggested, I think over time that will erode, because I do believe that some of the economies of Asia will be seen as very strong, and counter. So there's a big debate looming about the future of the international monetary system.
Thank you very much. Well, bringing it to a conclusion, this was a session that perhaps because of the title and the context in which we are working, we focused on all the bad things that are associated with capital flows. One day, we heard very eloquent exposition of different points of view on how to manage capital flows. One day I want to have a session on capital flows that will discuss in some depth what are the benefits from having large capital flows, whether it is the transfer of capital and resources to countries that need the most, or the benefits of giving people the ability to diversify their portfolios in global markets, and so on and so forth. There are, of course, many benefits to these capital flows, and we want to, at some point, have a discussion of that that aspect. Let me therefore bring it to a conclusion. Ask you to join me in thanking the panelists. I think they did a terrific job.